Hi everyone, welcome to History of Asia. For the newcomers, we discuss the history of every Asian region, starting in the present, then diving ever deeper into the past. We are currently traveling through the history of Iran, and have now arrived in the time of the Sasanians. That Persian dynasty dominated most of the Middle East, starting from 224 CE until the Muslim takeover in the midst of the 7th century. In the previous episode, we already talked elaborately about their religion, Zoroastrianism, and how it affected all aspects of society. We also discussed its influence on Islam. But the Sasanians also impacted other world religions. The definitive Talmud of the Jews, for instance, was compiled in their lands. And without the Sasanians, there would be no Nestorian Christians either. But religious influences are far from the only mark that they left on world history. And if you think about it, this is only to be expected. Most of the lands that the first caliphate took over formerly belonged to the Sasanian Empire. So as the new masters, the Muslims had little choice but to adopt much of the institutions and culture that they found there. Persian administrators usually kept their posts for generations after the takeover. The main government branches in pre-modern Muslim states, the Divan and the Vizier, evolved out of Sasanian institutions. The Abbasid caliphs took on Persian ideas of kingship and used Sasanian manuals that explained them how to govern. The Abbasid period is often described as a renaissance of the Sasanian Empire even, and the caliphal court would in turn act as a shining example for countless sultanates and emirates. But the Sasanians' impact goes further still. It also encompasses, say, the arts. Many art forms that we regard as quintessentially Islamic in fact predate Islam. The elegant architecture that typifies classical mosques, for instance. Although there were some adaptations over the years, of course. Same thing with calligraphy. And again, little wonder, even leaving aside the prestige of Persian culture, the Arabs, by necessity, had to employ craftsmen, scribes, and artists that they found on the spot. Indirectly, the Sasanians also affected Europe. Aspects of their court etiquette, for instance, were imitated by the Byzantine emperor, and he, in turn, would serve as an example for Christian courts all over Europe. At least indirectly, the Sasanians played their part in the emergence of Europe's medieval codes of chivalry, which in turn affect modern concepts of romantic love. Sasanian methods of warfare were similarly copied in the West, although it must be said that the influence could go in the other direction as well. As the Sasanians and the Byzantines were constantly at war, they had to adapt to each other's military innovations. Sasanian influence stretches far beyond the Middle Ages. For instance, they would help preserve the philosophical and scientific heritage of classical Europe. After the fall of the Western Roman Empire, these traditions were neglected for centuries, despite the efforts of monks who laboriously copied pagan classics. But while the Byzantines eventually closed down the famous Platonic school, the Persian King of Kings, Khosrow I, welcomed its members with open arms. Not without reason, he became known as Plato's philosopher king. When the Muslims took over Sasanian lands, they inherited this scholarly tradition and used it to their advantage. In the old Sasanian heartland, scholars like Al-Kindi, Al-Farabi, and Avicenna would build upon the works of the ancient classic Greeks. The libraries of Abbasid Baghdad emulated Khosrow's example by trying to collect all the available knowledge of the known world. By the Renaissance, it found its way back to Europe, and the rest is history. And yet, despite their unquestionable importance, I'll bet that most people never even heard of the Sasanians. In the West, courses on ancient history always follow the same pattern. They start by discussing the ancient civilizations of the Near East, but only as some sort of introduction. You get the impression that this is by necessity. It seems like all they really want to talk about is Europe. But before the 6th century BCE, that continent was still mostly covered in the darkness of prehistory. while the Middle East was already home to major empires for millennia. As soon as classical Greece gets off the ground, the focus shifts westward and the textbooks lose all interest in the Near East. It's as if, after the conquests of Alexander the Great, nothing of importance happens there anymore. But then what happened to all these ancient cultures in the cradle of civilization? Whatever became of the inheritors of Babylon, Assyria, and ancient Persia? Had they suddenly become irrelevant? Well, it would seem so. In reality, however, after the rule of Alexander's successors, the area around Iran and Mesopotamia was once again absorbed by great Asian empires. First the Parthians, who galloped in from the steppe, and then the Sasanians. As a rule, both these peoples are totally ignored, which is a shame. It's tempting to write this off as a matter of Eurocentrism, but though that is partly true, there are in fact very good reasons why history books devote little attention to them. There is simply very little known for certain about them. When I started researching this topic, I found, to my astonishment, that it's hard to find good books on the subject. And I am not the only one who found this puzzling, apparently. For I have here a very good book by a specialist scholar named Turay Darier, pronounced differently, no doubt, and I depend heavily on this work. It will become plain why when I read you the first line of his introduction. Listen to this, quote, "The impetus for writing a history of the Sasanian Empire arose from the fact that there currently are no books on this period of Persian-Iranian history in the English language," end quote. And just to be clear, this book was only published as recently as 2013. Helpfully, the author then goes on to explain why this is. Not only did the people of the Sasanian Empire speak very different languages that today almost no one understands, they also used a large variety of scripts. The language of the central administration, run by the priests, was Pahlavi, yes, like the later dynasty. But there were many local languages as well. And let's not forget, there were throngs of war captives from Rome and other places. And their descendants spoke a multitude of other languages. Greek, Germanic, Slavic, you name it. A scholar who wants to study this era is faced with the Herculean task of having to familiarize himself with many of these languages and scripts. It's not so surprising, then, that few have had the stomach for this. As you can imagine, the Islamic Republic is not so eager to get people excited about Iran's pre-Islamic past either. The Pahlavi Shahs did that precisely to lessen the influence of the clerics that now run the show. But even in the Pahlavi era, scholars used to focus mainly on the Achaemenids rather than the Sasanians. So archives are not freely accessible to scholars, let alone to those from the English-speaking world. And finally, surprisingly little source material has survived from this period. So despite the unmistakable importance of this giant and long-lasting empire, even the experts know frustratingly little about it. Unfortunately, I think it's likely to remain that way for the foreseeable future. But here is the good news. That which we do know is fascinating beyond belief. Well, if you're like me. So let's talk about these Sasanians. And why not begin at the beginning for a change? Before they came to power, the region was run by the Parthians. Well, on paper anyway. For although there's no question that they were formidable warriors, they had bested the renowned Roman legions more than once after all, they never formed a strong central government. Local barons always kept a lot of power. In the dying days of the Parthian Empire, there was very little central authority left to speak of. However, the Sasanians were unlikely candidates to fill this power vacuum, for they didn't even rule their own semi-independent province of Persis at the time. They were a family of priests devoted to the goddess Anahita. The father of the first Sasanian king overthrew his local ruler, and his son Ardashir would conquer the rest of the Parthian Empire from there. Well, conquer may be too strong a word even. It was probably not so much a matter of military conquest, but rather a changing of the guard. Tellingly, Pashan and other noble families retained an important position under Ardashir if they switched their allegiance to him. So at first, it seemed that a new empire would very much resemble the old one. Had that been the case, there would be little reason to discuss the Pashans and the Sasanians separately. In fact, the levels of centralization that Iran would reach under the Sasanians would rarely, if ever, be matched until modern times. How was that possible? Well, two things were needed, intent and opportunity. And both were present in the person of the second Sasanian king of kings, or Shahanshah, Shapur. Shapur was no doubt a formidable character with a strong vision, but he had luck on his side too. For starters, his father had decided to appoint him co-emperor. Had he not done this, then Shapur would not have had any experience in the arts of government when he ascended the throne. Later princes were also tasked with ruling a province, so that they would be ready when one of them was made king. At first, their father would himself decide whom that would be, but in later times, the nobility and the priests got to make that choice. Shapur was lucky in other ways too. Rome, the traditional enemy of Persia, was in the midst of its infamous crisis of the 3rd century, and this enabled the Persians to march all the way to the Mediterranean. It was this string of unbelievable victories that gave Shapur the means and the prestige he needed to transform his country into a much more centralized entity. Now, we are used to seeing the Roman emperors as the most powerful men of their day, but Shapur alone managed to kill one emperor, take another one captive, and force a third to pay tribute. How many people in history could say that? Must I still convince you that the Sasanians don't deserve to be ignored? I guess if the Romans were the United States of their day, then the Sasanians and the Parthians before them would be like the Soviet Union. And then Shapur would be like Brezhnev if he had Lyndon Johnson assassinated, forced Channel 4 to send him lots of taxpayer dollars, and kidnapped Nixon and used him as a footstool, with a couple of atomic bombs dropped on Alaska for good measure, perhaps. Everyone would remember what Brezhnev looked like if he had. Shapur reminds me a lot of Abbas the Great, the Safavid Shah who managed to centralize power at the expense of the barons. For both men, it was war that necessitated the construction of a powerful army under central command. Military triumphs cemented the troops' loyalty to the monarch, and military success was important for its symbolic value and the legitimacy that it wrought. But just as important were the spoils. Shapur and Abbas both won possession of the Fertile Crescent. This greatly enhanced the economic possibilities of their respective empires. The Safavids were very formidable as long as they controlled that region. But as soon as they lost its agricultural wealth again, this reduced their power accordingly. The Sasanians were all too aware of its importance too, which is attested by the fact that, like the Parthians before them, they made Ctesiphon in Mesopotamia their capital. This was a city near the old Babylon, by the way. This had one disadvantage though. Rome's legions were very close by, and this would ensure more conflicts along the way. Both these giants were constantly at war with one another, sometimes directly. In 363, for instance, the Emperor Julian, after landing on the coast, ordered the sinking of his fleet. He intended to show his troops that retreat was not an option, no doubt. In an earlier episode, we already talked about the tactic of burning your bridges behind you, or your ships. Sometimes it can work, but this time it backfired. The Persians did retreat, but they burned the farms and crops behind them so that the Romans would have nothing to eat. Once they were close to starvation, the Persians fell upon them and slaughtered them, including the emperor. In terms of human suffering, the cost of all this warfare was of course terrible, but for the King of Kings, these recurring confrontations may have been a blessing in disguise. They necessitated the continued existence of a powerful standing army. In the beginning, the Sasanian military had very much resembled the Parthian one, being heavily dependent on horse archers. No wonder it mostly consisted of the same troops. But in the following centuries, it would change beyond recognition. The armed forces became more varied, employing a mix of infantry, archers, cavalry, and even Indian elephants. Although hard to handle, when used wisely, these beasts could be immensely intimidating. The Sasanians learned a lot about how to build siege engines from their Roman war captives, so they could also make scorpions, catapults, ballistas, and whatnot. Perhaps the only part of the army with a poor reputation was the navy. But that's typical. Iran has never been a great sea power in its history. What the Sasanian armies were most known for, however, was their heavy cavalry. These riders wielded an impressive arsenal of weapons, including a bow, a mace, a shield, a sword, and a lance. Makes you kind of wonder how they managed to carry all these things around with just one pair of hands. Both horse and rider were protected by plate mail, so they were much better able to withstand arrow fire than regular cavalry, which was an easy target. Armor was expensive, though, and the fact that the Sasanians used so much of it probably attests to the wealth of their dynasty. The Byzantines adopted such cataphracts too, and for the same reasons. These can be seen as perhaps the earliest prototype of the mounted knight, that icon of the European High Middle Ages. Speaking of which, the Sasanian warrior nobles had honor codes very similar to those of later knights. They too were supposed to be protectors of the weak and women, and to fulfill their oaths. There are even indications that lying was a punishable offense, something that is connected to the religion. The Zoroastrian god Mazda stood for the truth, while the devil was known as the lie. The nobles took pride in dueling, jousting, and hunting, but also in poetry, calligraphy, and music. So the ideal was that of a cultured warrior, you might say. But the accent always lay on the warrior part. The king himself was presented as the alpha among alpha males. He was always depicted fighting or hunting lions. When he actually went hunting, he would bring along a large retinue of harp players, elephants, and all manner of servants, who had to make the hunt as pleasant as possible. I suppose any lions they might encounter would have heard them coming from miles away, and perhaps for the best. For if by any chance the king ran into a dangerous animal anyway, he'd better not have had too much wine, I suppose. Now that the Shahanshah had such a mighty army at his side, the barons could no longer retain their autonomy like they had under the Parthians. This enabled the monarch to build a centralized bureaucracy, and this in turn enabled a more efficient collection of taxes on behalf of the treasury, making the nobles dependent financially too. Shapur, in effect, started a spiral of centralization. Local barons were henceforth kept on a short leash. There were royal spies in their courts, tasked with warning the King of Kings at any whiff of treason. They couldn't be anywhere at once, but the thought of being watched may have been just as important in keeping the nobles in line as the actual surveillance itself. But apart from such sticks, they used carrots aplenty too. In return for accepting Sasanian sovereignty, noble houses were rewarded with a seat at a table. A bit like in Game of Thrones, where the leading families of the Seven Kingdoms all sent someone to the king's small council to be given some ministerial duty in the larger entity. Master of Coin, for instance, or Master of Whispers, aka the Spy Master. Making local rulers subservient by seducing them with a function in the larger entity, that's a clever ploy, used throughout history. But not everyone is motivated by the quest for power. Some just want to party. And the king would make sure that his court was the hottest place in town. With all the money that he was raking in, he had more than enough for some conspicuous consumption. The Sasanians counted on it that the glamorous court lifestyle would seduce the nobles, that they would prefer to be part of the king's entourage instead of living in some faraway outpost. You see this more often in centralizing kingdoms, like the France of Louis XIV, the Sun King, and indeed, many became absent landlords, leaving the government of their estates to the so-called decans, who became ever more important as a consequence. Like in Versailles, There was no lack of amusement. You had snake charmers, rope walkers, jugglers and exotic animals, among a host of other things. The cook, apparently, had to cover his mouth so that he would not spoil the exquisite food with his lowly breath. Nice touch that added to the sense of exclusivity, I imagine. There were concubines, dancing girls and singers. Especially interesting about the latter, I find, is that only a special kind of voice was deemed appropriate for certain roles. One sort of voice was meant for the singer who represented the hero in the song, another for the bad guy. There was at least as much typecasting going on as in Hollywood, you might say. The Sasanians loved their music. Even readings of the Avesta were to be accompanied by instruments. This gives us a sense of the kind of decadence, in air quotes, that the Arabs would find so repulsive in their Persian enemies. It was no doubt a pleasant experience, but this wasn't just indulgence for its own sake. These feasts had to be lavish for symbolic reasons. Fine exotic objects and dishes brought over from remote places demonstrated how big and prosperous the king's lands in fact were. People had to make merry so as to show that all was well in the kingdom. Subtle and not so subtle rituals were devised to put the honored guests in their place. They would, for instance, lie down on couches, and you could tell who enjoyed the highest favor by counting the amount of pillows that they had, or by measuring their distance to the king. He was the centerpiece of the spectacle. He wore colorful clothing, makeup, and a beard adorned with gold. His crown must have been so massive, it had to be attached to the ceiling and floated above his head. Alas, all this was not meant for mortal eyes, for the Shahanshah would be hidden behind a curtain, and the so-called keeper of the curtain had to pass on his messages. The Shahanshah would not demean himself by talking to a common person. So court rituals made it very plain that the king stood way above everyone else. If one had the rare honor of approaching him, then that person had to drop to the floor, flat on his face. Only twice a year, the king would reveal himself to his subjects, on the Nowruz festival, and then again 6 months later. On those occasions, the symbolic bond between the king and the estates was re-emphasized by exchanging symbolic gifts. The first caliphs didn't adopt these practices, that would have offended the more egalitarian Arabs, but the Abbasids reintroduced the habit of distancing themselves from the hoi polloi. Just as interestingly, there were similar rituals in Roman and Chinese courts at the time. There too, visitors had to kowtow before a hidden emperor. Dariae suggests that they must have learned about each other's ways of doing things and wanted to rival each other's greatness, like snobs that tried to outdo each other. This also shows how the Byzantine and Persian emperors grudgingly came to admire one another. By the 400s, their mutual respect had become so strong that the one ruler asked the other to take custody of his heir, implying that he placed more trust in his geopolitical rival than in the people at his own court, and perhaps wisely so, for while the prince could in theory be used as leverage, well, that would spoil a unique chance to foster close bonds with the next ruler, so he could be expected to be treated well. But try to imagine such an arrangement today, right? The Persians learned a lot from their Byzantine enemies and vice versa. In the many wars against their Western foe, the Sasanians took many skillful people captive. They were then resettled or put to work in royal factories, where they had to fabricate things like war machines. This became an important part of the economy, controlled by the king. More importantly even, they helped build cities, again, rarely by choice though. Iran is traditionally a land of small villages that could easily be bossed about by nomadic tribes. It's no coincidence that so many of its dynasties were nomadic in origin. That's one reason, we may suspect, why the Sasanians consciously adopted a policy of urbanization. And with success, people flocked to these cities in large numbers, especially in Mesopotamia, which by the end of the Sasanian reign had become one of the most densely populated regions in the entire world. These big cities were no longer easy prey for nomadic tribes, of course. Finding plunder, harder and less rewarding, they often enlisted in the army instead. With so many people living in cities, water control became more vital than ever, so irrigation pipes, or kanats, were built in unprecedented numbers. These so-called kanats can bring melting water from the mountains to valleys where they are needed. But they need care. If they are neglected for a time, as would happen in turbulent later periods, they would fall into disrepair, making agriculture all but impossible. The cities were also centers of trade. This may sound self-evident, perhaps. As a tourist in Iran, one of the first things you'd expect to find is a bazaar. It's the most iconic neighborhood in Middle Eastern cities, after all. But before the Sasanians, this was not at all the case. Tellingly, Herodotus informs us of a dispute in which an Achaemenid king mocks the Greeks for having agoras, where people came to lie to each other, as he put it. Lying may still have been punishable under the Sasanians, at least in some cases, but this didn't stop them from encouraging the formation of bazaars. One reason for this may be that it rendered traders and artisans easier to control. Not unlike in medieval cities, every activity had its own place in the bazaar and its own guild. Because commerce was so concentrated, it could easily be supervised, including prices. This would become a long-lasting habit that sometimes would cause offense, as shahs tended to blame greedy merchants for inflation, for example. They wouldn't always accept that. The bazaar became the main center of opposition against the late Qajars, for instance, or the Pahlavis. But already under the Sasanians, cities had an outsized political impact, which put pressure on the government to acknowledge the concerns of their inhabitants. Many of these were descendants of war captives, adhering to foreign creeds. Merchants often followed minority religions, since Zoroastrians held their job in low esteem. So the cities became hotbeds of cultural and religious diversity. The King of Kings had to be attentive to the needs of traders and minorities. That, however, would irritate the clergy. For those who have listened to the episodes on the Safavids, doesn't all that sound familiar to you? In his drive for centralization, Shapur's most important partner had been the great mage Kerdir. He laid the basis for a clerical hierarchy closely linked to the state. The incredible variety of magi is testament to the range of their responsibilities. You had those that served the holy fires, but also theologians, counselors, overseers of tax collection, judges, and countless others. In fact, even the kings had started off as priests themselves. We've seen in the previous episode that the clerical establishment eventually became the true power behind the throne in many respects, like the later Safavids would be overpowered by Islamic clerics. But figures like Shapur or Abbas could not be intimidated by the respective religious authorities. Their standing was too impressive. The Magi were important for Shapur. By spreading Zoroastrian orthodoxy, they would help his dynasty get nationwide legitimacy. But Shapur didn't become completely dependent on them, for he had more than enough other tools in his toolbox, like strong loyal forces and lots of money. As we've seen, Shapur brought that point home by allowing the prophet Mani to return to Iran. He even invited him over for a chat, and then granted him permission to preach all over the land. Mani's worldview could be summarized by a line from Tom Waits: "Did the devil make the world while God was sleeping?" This ran completely contrary to Zoroastrian ideas, which celebrated life and praised Ahura Mazda for creating the earth and all good things on it. Kerdir must have been grinding his teeth at Shapur's tolerance towards Mani, but Shapur may have done this precisely to remind him who was boss. It must have been obvious that Kerdir was a man of great ambitions. He would have the last laugh, however. When Shapur left the scene, he was first followed by a younger son of his. As we said, the oldest didn't always inherit the throne. But shortly after, the elder brother, Wahram, did come to power, apparently with the support of Kerdir, who wielded a lot of influence. Perhaps as a thank you, he ended his father's tolerance towards Manichaeism, and he had Mani killed. We may speculate that Vakram's understanding with Gerdir and Shapur's mistrust of the latter might explain why Shapur had bypassed Vakram in favor of his younger brother. Gerdir's influence kept growing under Vakram's successor, Vakram II. He then became boss over all the fire temples, including that of Anahita, which the Sasanians had themselves guarded up to that point. On becoming kings, they hadn't ceased being a priestly family until then. The ruler was slowly being pushed out of the Magi's domain, and this domain was expanding. Court cases would henceforth be based on Zoroastrian law, for instance. Tellingly, from the 300s onward, the King of Kings was no longer considered a descendant from the gods. Meanwhile, the Magi did meddle in politics. If a king's policies towards other religions were too tolerant for their taste, they pushed back. They were even capable of tarnishing a king's reputation for good. Yazdegerd, for instance, who ruled around 400 CE, was tagged with the nickname the Sinner. Now that sounds awful, but it was probably because he was too lenient towards Christians. It was a sign of the times. In the following century, it became common practice for the high clergy to depose the Shahan Shah or intervene in his succession. The Magi created and cemented the caste system with themselves on top of the pyramid, and they equated that hierarchy with the cosmic order. It was the king's sacred duty to uphold it. If he failed to do this, he would lose his right to rule. This right was seen as something almost visible, a sort of aura or charisma that would be bestowed upon him by Ahura Mazda, that surrounded him and that would leave him once he stopped being righteous. The nobles were also tasked with protecting the system, and this at once legitimized their position within it. This was a caste society rather than a class-based order, so getting rich didn't guarantee you higher standing. Merchants, though sometimes very prosperous, remained on the lower rungs of the societal ladder. The idea behind this may have been that they contaminated society with alien influences and ideas. Now, perhaps we shouldn't feel too much pity for the rich merchant, but what about the unfortunates who found themselves stuck at the bottom, economically and socially? If they accepted their fate, they would be praised for that. It was a religious duty to aid them, and hell awaited those that didn't. Religious endowments and fire temples were tasked with philanthropy. Under Sasanian law, one was allowed to give a third of one's wealth for the sake of his soul, and this money then went into the Zoroastrian version of the boniats. In reality, like in the Islamic Republic, it seems doubtful whether this benefited more than a select group of people. What about the others? Well, if you were openly unhappy with your lot, if you refused to accept the so-called divine order of things, you could be branded an outcast. And like in present-day India, that was not something you would want. You could also be flogged, mutilated, or jailed. The growing group of malcontents could become a danger to society if they banded together. Street gangs developed their own honor code of robbing the rich and helping the poor. Such groups continue to emerge in modern times, by the way, then known as lutis. Such gangs were often employed by local power brokers, including clergymen. But if you have too many such discontents, they may start a revolution. And in the case of the Sasanians, this revolution may have been Mazdakism. We talked in the previous episode about how Mazdak and his followers redistributed a property on a vast scale, with the king's consent. Eventually, the movement was repressed, however, and by the time that the Muslims arrived on the scene, you still had plenty of societal tensions at play. Another group of discontents, we can assume, were the slaves, and there were lots of them. You could become a slave in many ways, by falling into debt, for instance, or by being captured during a campaign. Slaves could earn wages, they were allowed to have their own families, and they were often released, so in that sense, I guess they were better off than black slaves in modern America. But of course, they had no enviable life. Female slaves were just as vulnerable to the lust of male owners, to mention just one thing. This too might have made Sasanian lands vulnerable to the Muslims, as officially no Muslim could enslave another. To all these slaves, therefore, conversion could look like a road to freedom, a way out. Yet another group with reasons to fret about their lot were women. As you can imagine, in a society where castes are so strictly regulated, that was true for the position of the sexes as well. Women had to cover their heads already, for instance. So this is not at all an introduction by the Muslims. In fact, the habit of feeling women goes back way further still in this region. It was indicative of their low status. The women of high birth may have enjoyed relatively high levels of freedom. Most others were simply considered property, and you can take that very literally. Men even had the right to sell their wives off. And as for union outside marriage, that was considered theft. So yes, as far as the Sasanians were concerned, women were things. Things with duties, no less. They had to kneel before their husband 3 times a day and ask what he would have of them. He could take another wife if he so pleased, and unlike in Islam, the principal wife then had more rights than the others. Inequality between husband and wife was not just the official state of affairs, it was also all but guaranteed in a practical sense, because women had to wed at age 9 already, while boys only at age 15, and this was religiously mandated. The reasoning was that conception was a holy duty, and that such marriages supposedly would maximize the number of children. By contrast, any act that involved the spilling of semen was considered sinful. This included abortion, for instance, but also sex with a barren woman, and of course, sodomy. There was just one thing, apparently, that was considered so good and holy that it could balance out something as vile as sodomy. And that was, wait for it, a very incestuous marriage. I kid you not, father and daughter, brother and sister, the more incestuous the better, apparently. Wow. Well, this has happened in other communities too, occasionally, to keep money or power in the family. I don't know of many other places where this was religiously sanctioned, and not just for the nobility, for everybody. This, again, had to do with the ideas of contamination that the Magi were so obsessed about. The blood had to remain pure, and that was best done by keeping it in the family, or so they must have reasoned. Speaking of impure blood, when they had their period, women had to refrain from most activities, so as not to pollute, well, anything. They even had to hide away until that terrible affliction had passed. Nope, I wouldn't exactly call them woke, these people, but then again, few people were at that time. It goes without saying, I think, that all these views are no longer acceptable for either Iranians or Zoroastrians today. They differ as much from the Sasanians as today's Christians differ from the Crusaders. We all have ancestors that did crazy shit. Nonetheless, as you can imagine, in certain circles, the idea of widespread inbreeding in Sasanian society is very controversial. But according to Turay Darieh, the sources indicate that this was the case. Now, I myself am unqualified to take a position, but there is something that makes me doubt this nonetheless. They say in Game of Thrones that whether the offspring of brother and sister will be healthy and sane, that amounts to a flip of the coin. Even if that is too strongly put, suppose you really have generation upon generation upon generation of such unions. How do you think that would affect society in the long run? The fact that we hear nothing about that makes me suspect it cannot have been so widespread after all. But as I said, I'm not qualified to have an opinion. I just find it fascinating to wonder about. And as always, I mean no offense by bringing it up. Anyway, before I was digressing, I was talking about these different groups that could expect to profit from a Muslim takeover. Outcasts, slaves, women. Perhaps we can add to that list the merchants. The Magi looked down on trade, as we said already, while the founder of Islam was himself a trader, and Islam would often spread by trade routes. However, Trade was already important for the Sasanians too, never mind what the Magi thought of it. And so were the minorities that dominated it. So arrangements were made to keep them quiet. Minorities didn't have to follow Zoroastrian law when it came to their own differences. They were allowed to use their own judicial codes. The Christian bishop and Jewish exilarch resided in the capital and paid taxes, raised from their own respective communities. In return, their followers would enjoy official tolerance. This looks strikingly similar to the system that the Muslims would instate, in which the so-called people of the book were protected if they paid a special infidel tax. A similar system remained in place as late as Ottoman times. Nonetheless, in the 4th century, Christianity would be regarded as a national security threat. And little wonder, the Roman emperor had appointed himself protector of that religion. And in Sasanian lands, this naturally rendered all Christians suspect. They did their best not to cause offense, though. And they found ways around taboos. For instance, Zoroastrians objected to burying bodies because it would pollute the earth. So the Christians buried their dead in tombs above ground or in rocks. Eventually, they went so far as to found a breakaway religion, a new Christian church, Nestorianism. Nestorians didn't forbid their priests to marry. Forced celibacy was yet another of these Christian practices that the Magi objected to. As far as they were concerned, procreation was a divine duty. But most importantly, the Nestorian sect distanced itself from the Byzantine emperor. Eventually, the Shahanshah would even co-opt them himself. So by the last century of Sasanian rule, the Christians were no longer regarded as a fifth column. What also may have contributed to this was that Christian and Jewish women had been allowed to wed Zoroastrian men. The idea was that the man would be the dominant player in the household anyway, and that he would influence his wife, not the other way around. For the same reasons, Muslim men would later be allowed to marry Christians too. But in reality, the influence must have gone in the other direction as well, at least at times. Christian women at court had the ear of their husbands and sons. There were even kings with Christian wives. I imagine this helped normalize the position of Christendom in society, despite the Magi's misgivings. One of these kings was Khosrow II. In the second episode on the early Muslim conquests, we talked about how this King of Kings captured a fragment of the Holy Cross from Jerusalem, remember? Now, this was not merely done as a provocation. Khosrow also did it to hasten his standing among his own Christian subjects. The idea of Iran had long been associated with the Zoroastrian religion, but by the end of the Sasanian period, the idea of Iranian citizenship surpassed religion. All creeds that were accepted, in turn, accepted this idea, which meant all of them, except the Manichaeans. In this regard, they were in the same position as the Baha'i are today. This idea of an inclusive Iran would endure, and that would be unthinkable if it had still been connected to Zoroastrianism. Until now, I've mainly focused on the strengths of the Sasanians, how they managed to centralize, how they contained religious disagreements, occasions when they defeated the Romans, and so on. But it would be wrong to paint too rosy a picture. Centralization would eventually be rolled back, as the court nobility was demoted to the advantage of gentry, known as the decans. This process had already begun when these local lords were tasked with managing the affairs of the nobles, who were soon too busy having fun in the capital. Although these decans were usually loyal to the king, this meant a return to a more fragmented political landscape. When later the court was divided or in turmoil, the local lords could do as they pleased, and when the Arabs arrived, many of them were open to a deal. Moreover, although we know next to nothing about the thoughts of the common man, Mazdak's rise was probably a sign of discontent that was brewing. Killing him, and even burying thousands of his followers alive, that didn't suffice to put this genie back in the bottle. In fact, the rise of the decans may have been bad news for farmers, since they knew the situation on the ground, the Deccans would be more aware of the actual worth of the land and so better able to tax it. Social and economic problems were still festering, so much is clear. On the higher rungs of society, things were hardly more stable. Magi and court nobles could still put pressure on lesser kings. They were still supposed to uphold the unequal divine order and show themselves aggressive warriors, even if that was not in the best interests of the realm. Some wars were risky and pointless. Religious and social repression stoked popular anger, but the king had to do it sometimes in order to survive. It reminds me of what a Belgian politician not so long ago said in a moment of jaw-dropping honesty. "We know what needs to be done, we just don't know how to get re-elected once we've done it." We already talked about societal and religious tensions, but what about the wars? Wasn't that how the Sasanian Empire was built? Well, although some Persian kings indeed won remarkable victories against the Romans, when these enjoyed relative peace in the other corners of their empire, they could give the Persians a run for their money as well, especially if the Sasanians were themselves kept busy on other borders. Arab raids were already an issue early on. In the 4th century, King Shapur II built a line of fortifications known as the Arab Wall. A bit like with Hadrian's Wall, this was a way of saying, it's no longer really profitable to expand here, we're gonna try and hold on to what we have. But although you couldn't pursue these camel riders into their desert, they were not yet a mortal threat. That could not be said from the new enemy that began to threaten Persia from the eastern steppe, however, the Huns. The most dangerous proved to be the White Huns, perhaps better known as the Hephthalites. From the moment that they showed up on Persia's borders, they remained a constant menace. When they clashed with the Sasanians, it wasn't always the same party that won. For instance, in a disastrous campaign in 469, they captured the Sasanian king Peros along with his entire harem. As payment for his return, the Persian had to cede land and bring tribute to the Hephthalites. To ensure payment, both the chief priest and the king's son had to stay behind with the Huns as hostages. Luckily for the Persians, the Romans were in no position to take advantage of this crisis, since they were faced with multiple revolts themselves. Still, it was quite a humiliation. And this was one of these moments when it became plain that the king's marketing as a great warrior could come back to haunt him. Peros could not simply swallow his pride and act as if nothing had happened. No one would take him seriously then. He had to get even with the Huns, no matter what it took. So against his better judgment, probably, he attacked them again. He paid for it with his life and that of his troops. Troops that would prove hard to replace. And meanwhile, the forced payments to the Huns contributed to a long period of economic decline. And if that wasn't bad enough, the empire was also confronted with severe droughts and other misfortunes at the time. The Hephthalites even interfered in the internal politics of Ctesiphon, for example, by reinstating the deposed King Cavad in 499. I guess the Sasanians considered themselves lucky when a few decades later the White Huns fell apart due to infighting. Not unusual for a tribal confederation. The other nomadic invaders would soon show up. Still, you can almost hear a sigh of relief, I think, for this bought the Sasanians some valuable time. It gave them the chance to regain their strength and even expand their influence to new regions like southern Arabia. This added another layer to the rivalry with Byzantium, though. The Persians already controlled the overland passage to India. Now that they also expanded their control over the sea route, Roman customers were at the mercy of the Persian middlemen, who could exact exorbitant prices. Even though these traders were not in the service of the Persian king, the Byzantines found this unacceptable. It would entice them to team up with the Ethiopian kingdom of Aksum, which subsequently clashed with a local Persian client in Yemen. And as we saw at the end of the previous series, this would have direct ramifications for Mecca in the time of the Prophet. Persian dominance of the sea trade also gave the Omanis an extra reason for joining the Muslim cause. United, the Arabs could drive the Persians from their coast. In the 530s, it seems as if Persia was about to enter a new golden age. The lowering religious tensions enabled internal peace, well, relatively speaking. After the low point of Mazdakian revolution, palace coups and civil war, order was now restored under Khosrow I, perhaps the most august ruler that the Sasanians ever had. He was brought to power with the backing of the nobles and the clergy, who hoped that he would end the Mazdakite problem for good. This gave him a fine chance to strengthen his own position. Apart from that, he also defeated the Hephthalites as well as the Turks and closed a treaty with the Emperor Justinian that was optimistically called the Eternal Peace. A bit too over-optimistically, as it lasted less than a decade, but still, under Khosrow's long reign, the empire was on one of its all-time highs. And yet, this was misleading. In fact, most of the dynamics that would lead to the Sasanians' eventual downfall were already in place. A multifaceted rivalry with Byzantium, a still combustible cocktail of social unrest, with lots of people resenting their ascribed place in society, renewed decentralization, simultaneous threats on multiple borders, forcing the Sasanian army to overstretch itself, literally, over a vast area, and soon enough, murderous factionalism at court. Khosrow I was very secure in his position, and perhaps his successor therefore supposed that he had inherited this position. Yet he was in for a nasty surprise then. He made many enemies at court, and when he haughtily mocked his general Bahram, the courtiers helped him take the capital. The victorious general meant to instate a puppet king named Khosrow II, but the latter understandably wasn't going to wait around until his region grew tired of him. He fled to Byzantium, where the Emperor Maurice welcomed him and promised to bring him back on his throne, which he did. It was impossible to foresee, but this would prove the final nail in the coffin. Kings were supposed to be great warriors, and above all, to defeat their Roman nemesis. But this one was ostensibly brought to power by the Romans. How do you think that would look in the eyes of his subjects and nobles? Note that Maurice might have made his life easy by sending Khosrow back to Bakram in chains. He wouldn't have had to spill a drop of blood then, and still, he would have had a good bond with his neighbor. But it seems he reckoned it would be better to have a really weak King of Kings on the Sasanian throne. If so, that proved to be short-sighted, because while a strong King of Kings could have afforded to remain friends with Byzantium, Khosrow would do whatever it took to win back his prestige, even if that meant gambling with his crown and the future of the empire. His chance came when Maurice was himself overthrown. Khosrow could then attack the Byzantines in the name of his friendship with Maurice to restore the true emperor's line. At first, it went better than expected, and the empire became bigger than ever. It even looked as if Constantinople itself would fall. But then, the tables turned. The Persians failed to take the Roman capital, and the new emperor Heraclius launched a daring counteroffensive deep into Persian lands, burning fire temples as he went. And perhaps most importantly, the new nomadic invader, the Turks, attacked Persia at the same time, which sealed Khosrow's fate and his prestige, as the Romans retook all the conquered lands. The King of Kings died as a broken man, killed by the nobles, reputedly with the help of his own son, who thence became king himself. During his short reign, the new king massacred the greater part of the royal family before being assassinated himself. Maybe at Heraclius's instigation, the main Persian general then took the capital and killed all those who'd had a hand in Khosrow's murder, meaning most of the remaining possible legitimate kings. After he died too, the Persian elite had no choice. They held their noses and opted for a queen. Both Khosrow's daughters would become queen. They had survived the purges at least. Now that we know how women were usually treated in Sasanian Persia, we understand that the situation must have been really desperate before they would do such a thing. They did no worse than their male predecessors, but under these conditions, they couldn't last long either. Now, with the last of Khosrow's children gone, the problem of the succession became insurmountable. It became impossible to keep track of the changes of leadership, even. In 632, the last Jahan Shah came to power, Yazdegerd III, the young grandson of Khosrow II. He, however, was no longer king of kings in more than name. He constantly had to flee from his enemies, pleading for the support of whoever he encountered. And it's at that desperate moment that the Arabs attacked. There is a BBC podcast, In Our Time, that discusses the Sasanians. At the end of the conversation, one of the guests argues why he thinks all this didn't really weaken the Persian army all that much. It was still at its height, and that the Arabs won in spite of the Sasanian strength. But not everyone at the table seemed to agree, and although I am, as you know, not qualified to have an opinion, neither do I. The end of the Sasanians was movie-like, and eerily similar to that of Iran's last ever Shah. Yazdegerd III was killed by a miller who didn't recognize his king, but his son fled on to China, where he was welcomed by the mighty Tang Emperor. The emperor promised to help him regain his throne, and while this came to naught, he remained their honored guest for surprisingly long. And apparently, there is still a statue in Guizhong dedicated to Peroz, king of Persia. Thank you so much for listening. Talk to you next time. Bye.